My opponents had been quick to remind everyone about my antagonism toward the Queen, and had also found a witness to testify about my whereabouts during the murder. That testimony had left me without an alibi. The Council had decided there was enough evidence to send me to a full-fledged trial, where I would receive my verdict. Lissa had been trying desperately to get people's attention and convince them I'd been framed. She was having trouble finding anyone who would listen, however, because the entire Moroi royal court was consumed with preparations for Tatiana's elaborate funeral. A monarch's death was a big deal. Moroi and Dompiers, half-vampires like me, were coming from all over the world to see the spectacle. Food, flowers, decorations, even musicians. The full deal. If Tatiana had gotten married, I doubted the event would have been this elaborate. With so much activity and buzz, no one cared about me now. As far as most people were concerned, I was safely stashed away and unable to kill again. Tatiana's murderer had been found. Justice was served. Case closed. Before I could get a clear picture of Lissa's surroundings, a commotion at the jail jerked me back into my own head. Someone had entered the area and was speaking to the guards, asking to see me. It was my first visitor in days. My heart pounded, and I leapt up to the bars, hoping it was someone who would tell me this had all been a horrible mistake. My visitor wasn't quite who I'd expected. "Old man," I said wearily, "what are you doing here?" Abe Mazur stood before me. As always, he was a sight to behold. It was the middle of summer, hot and humid, seeing as we were right in the middle of rural Pennsylvania. But that didn't stop him from wearing a full suit. It was a flashy one, perfectly tailored and adorned with a brilliant purple silk tie and matching scarf that just seemed like overkill. Gold jewelry flashed against the dusky hue of his skin, and he looked like he'd recently trimmed his short black beard. Abe was a Moroi, and although he wasn't royal, he wielded enough influence to be. He also happened to be my father.
"I'm your lawyer," he said cheerfully. "Here to give you legal counsel, of course."
"You aren't a lawyer," I reminded him, "and your last bit of advice didn't work out so well." That was mean of me. Abe, despite having no legal training whatsoever, had defended me at my hearing. Obviously, since I was locked up and headed for trial, the outcome of that hadn't been so great. But, in all my solitude, I'd come to realize that he'd been right about something. No lawyer, no matter how good, could have saved me at the hearing. I had to give him credit for stepping up to a lost cause, though considering our sketchy relationship, I still wasn't sure why he had. My biggest theories were that he didn't trust royals and that he felt paternal obligation. In that order.
"My performance was perfect," he argued. "Whereas your compelling speech in which you said, 'If I was the murderer,' didn't do us any favors. Putting that image in the judge's head wasn't the smartest thing you could have done."
I ignored the barb and crossed my arms. "So what are you doing here? I know it's not just a fatherly visit. You never do anything without a reason."
"Of course not. Why do anything without a reason?"
"Don't start up with your circular logic," he winked.
"No need to be jealous. If you work hard and put your mind to it, you might just inherit my brilliant logic skills someday."
"Abe," I warned, "get on with it."
"Fine, fine," he said. "I've come to tell you that your trial might be moved up."
What? That's great news. At least I thought it was. His expression said otherwise. Last I'd heard, my trial might be months away. The mere thought of that, of being in this cell so long, made me feel claustrophobic again.
"Rose, you do realize that your trial will be nearly identical to your hearing. Same proof and a guilty verdict."
"Yeah, but there must be something we can do before that, right? Find evidence to clear me?" Suddenly, I had a good idea of what the problem was. When you say moved up, how soon are we talking?
Ideally, they'd like to do it after a new king or queen is crowned. You know, part of the post-coronation festivities.
His tone was flippant, but as I held his dark gaze, I caught the full meaning. Numbers rattled in my head. The funeral's this week, and the elections are right after. You're saying I could go to trial and be convicted in, what, practically 2 weeks? Abe nodded. I flew toward the bars again, my heart pounding in my chest. 2 weeks? Are you serious? When he'd said the trial had been moved up, I'd figured maybe it was a month away. Enough time to find new evidence. How would I have pulled that off? Unclear. Now, time was rushing away from me. 2 weeks wasn't enough, especially with so much activity at court. Moments ago, I'd resented the long stretch of time I might face. Now, I had too little of it, and the answer to my next question could make things worse. How long? I asked, trying to control the trembling in my voice. How long after the verdict until they carry out the sentence? I still didn't entirely know what all I'd inherited from Abe, but we seemed to clearly share one trait, an unflinching ability to deliver bad news.
Probably immediately.
Immediately. I backed up, nearly sat on the bed, and then felt a new surge of adrenaline. Immediately? So, 2 weeks? In 2 weeks, I could be dead. Because that was the thing. The thing that had been hanging over my head the moment it became clear someone had planted enough evidence to frame me. People who killed queens didn't get sent to prison. They were executed. Few crimes among Moroi and Dampiers got that kind of punishment. We tried to be civilized in our justice, showing we were better than the bloodthirsty Strigoi. But certain crimes, in the eyes of the law, deserved death. Certain people deserved it too, say like treasonous murderers. As the full impact of the future fell upon me, I felt myself shake and tears come dangerously close to spilling out of my eyes. That's not right, I told Abe. That's not right, and you know it!
Doesn't matter what I think, he said calmly. I'm simply delivering the facts.
2 weeks, I repeated. What can we do in 2 weeks? I mean, you've got some lead, right? Or you can find something by then? That's your specialty. I was rambling and knew I sounded hysterical and desperate. Of course, that was because I felt hysterical and desperate.
It's going to be difficult to accomplish much, he explained. The court's preoccupied with the funeral and elections. Things are disorderly, which is both good and bad.
I knew about all the preparations from watching Lyssa. I'd seen the chaos already brewing. Finding any sort of evidence in this mess wouldn't just be difficult. It could very well be impossible. 2 weeks. 2 weeks and I could be dead. I can't, I told Abe, my voice breaking. I'm not meant to die that way.
Oh?
He arched an eyebrow.
You know how you're supposed to die?
In battle. One tear managed to escape, and I hastily wiped it away. I'd always lived my life with a tough image. I didn't want that shattering, not now when it mattered most of all. In fighting, defending those I love, not through some planned execution.
This is a fight of sorts, he mused. Just not a physical one. 2 weeks is still 2 weeks. Is it bad? Yes. But it's better than 1 week, and nothing's impossible. Maybe new evidence will turn up. You simply have to wait and see.
I hate waiting. This room, it's so small, I can't breathe. It'll kill me before any executioner does.
I highly doubt it.
Abe's expression was still cool, with no sign of sympathy. Tough love.
You've fearlessly fought groups of Strogoi, yet you can't handle a small room?
It's more than that. Now I have to wait each day in this hole, knowing there's a clock ticking down to my death and almost no way to stop it.
Sometimes the greatest tests of our strength are situations that don't seem so obviously dangerous. Sometimes surviving is the hardest thing of all.
Oh, no. No! I stalked away, pacing in small circles. Do not start with all that noble crap. You sound like Dimitri when he used to give me his deep life lessons.
He survived this very situation. He's surviving other things, too.
Dimitri. I took a deep breath, calming myself before I answered. Until this murder mess, Dimitri had been the biggest complication in my life. A year ago, though it seemed like eternity, he'd been my instructor in high school, training me to be one of the Dompier guardians who protect Maroi. He'd accomplished that, and a lot more. We'd fallen in love, something that wasn't allowed. We'd managed it as best we could, even finally coming up with a way for us to be together. That hope had disappeared when he'd been bitten and turned Strogoi. It had been a living nightmare for me. Then, through a miracle no one had believed possible, Lyssa had used spirit to transform him back to a Dompier. But things unfortunately hadn't quite returned to how they'd been before the Strogoi attack. I glared at Abe. Dimitri survived this, but he was horribly depressed about it. He still is. About everything. The full weight of the atrocities he'd committed as a Strogoi haunted Dimitri. He couldn't forgive himself and swore he could never love anyone now. The fact that I had begun dating Adrian didn't help matters. After a number of futile efforts, I'd accepted that Dimitri and I were through. I'd moved on, hoping I could have something real with Adrian now.
Right,
Abe said dryly.
He's depressed, but you're the picture of happiness and joy.
I sighed. Sometimes talking to you is like talking to myself. Pretty damned annoying. Is there any other reason you're here, other than to deliver the terrible news? I would have been happier living in ignorance. I'm not supposed to die this way. I'm not supposed to see it coming. My death is not some appointment penciled in on a calendar. He shrugged.
I just wanted to see you. And your arrangements.
Yes, he had indeed, I realized. Abe's eyes had always come back to me as we spoke. There'd been no question I held his attention. There was nothing in our banter to concern my guards. But every so often, I'd see Abe's gaze flick around, taking in the hall, my cell, and whatever other details he found interesting. Abe had not earned his reputation as Zmei, the serpent, for nothing. He was always calculating, always looking for an advantage. It seemed my tendency toward crazy plots ran in the family.
I also wanted to help you pass the time.
He smiled, and from under his arm, he handed me a couple of magazines and a book through the bars.
Maybe this will improve things.
I doubted any entertainment was going to make my two-week death countdown more manageable. The magazines were fashion and hair-oriented. The book was The Count of Monte Cristo. I held it up, needing to make a joke, needing to do anything to make this less real. I saw the movie. Your subtle symbolism isn't really all that subtle. Unless you've hidden a file inside it.
The book's always better than the movie.
He started to turn away.
Maybe we'll have a literary discussion next time.
Wait. I toss the reading material onto the bed. Before you go, in this whole mess, no one's ever brought up who actually did kill her. When Abe didn't answer right away, I gave him a sharp look. You do believe I didn't do it, right? For all I knew, he did think I was guilty and was just trying to help anyway. It wouldn't have been out of character.
I believe my sweet daughter is capable of murder,
he said at last.
But not this one.
Then who did it?
That,
he said before walking away,
is something I'm working on.
But you just said we're running out of time. Abe! I didn't want him to leave. I didn't want to be alone with my fear. There's no way to fix this!
Just remember what I said in the courtroom,
he called back. He left my sight and I sat back on the bed, thinking back to that day in court. At the end of the hearing, he told me, quite adamantly, that I wouldn't be executed, or even go to trial. Abe Mazur wasn't one to make idle promises. But I was starting to think that even he had limits, especially since our timetable had just been adjusted. I again took out the crumpled piece of paper and opened it. It, too, had come from the courtroom, covertly handed to me by Ambrose, Tatiana's servant and boy toy. Rose, if you're reading this, then something terrible has happened. You probably hate me, and I don't blame you. I can only ask that you trust that what I did with the age decree was better for your people than what others had planned. There are some Maroi who want to force all Dampirs into service, whether they want it or not, by using compulsion. The age decree has slowed that faction down. However, I write to you with a secret you must put right, and it is a secret you must share with as few as possible. Vasilisa needs her spot on the council, and it can be done. She is not the last Dragomir. Another lives, the illegitimate child of Eric Dragomir. I know nothing else, but if you can find this son or daughter, you will give Vasilisa the power she deserves. No matter your faults and dangerous temperament, you are the only one I feel can take on this task. Waste no time in fulfilling it. Tatiana Ivashkov. The words hadn't changed since the other 100 times I'd read them, nor had the questions they always triggered. Was the note true? Had Tatiana really written it? Had she, in spite of her outwardly hostile attitude, trusted me with this dangerous knowledge? There were 12 royal families who made decisions for the Maroi, but for all intents and purposes, there might as well have only been 11. Lyssa was the last of her line, and without another member of the Dragomir family, Maroi law said she had no power to sit on and vote with the council that made our decisions. Some pretty bad laws had already been made, and if the note was true, more would come. Lyssa could fight those laws, and some people wouldn't like that, people who had already demonstrated their willingness to kill. Another Dragomir. Another Dragomir meant Lyssa could vote. One more council vote could change so much. It could change the Maroi world. It could change my world, say like whether I was found guilty or not. And certainly it could change Lyssa's world. All this time she'd believed she was alone. Yet, I uneasily wondered if she'd welcome a half-sibling. I accepted that my father was a scoundrel, but Lyssa had always held hers up on a pedestal, believing the best of him. This news would come as a shock, and although I'd trained my entire life to keep her safe from physical threats, I was starting to think there were other things she needed to be protected from as well. But first, I needed the truth. I had to know if this note had really come from Tatiana. I was pretty sure I could find out, but it involved something I hated doing. Well, why not? It wasn't like I had anything else to do right now. Rising from the bed, I turned my back to the bars and stared at the blank wall, using it as a focus point. Bracing myself, remembering that I was strong enough to keep control, I released the mental barriers I always subconsciously kept around my mind. A great pressure lifted from me, like air escaping a balloon. And suddenly, I was surrounded by ghosts. Chapter 2. As always, it was disorienting. Faces and skulls, translucent and luminescent, all hovered around me. They were drawn to me, swarming in a cloud as though they all desperately needed to say something. And really, they probably did. The ghosts that lingered in this world were restless, souls who had reasons that kept them from moving on. When Lyssa had brought me back from the dead, I'd kept a connection to their world. It had taken a lot of work and self-control to learn to block out the phantoms that followed me. The magical wards that protected the Moroi court actually kept most ghosts away from me. But this time, I wanted them here. Giving them that access, drawing them in, well, it was a dangerous thing. Something told me that if ever there was a restless spirit, it would be a queen who had been murdered in her own bed. I saw no familiar faces among this group, but didn't give up hope. Tatiana? I murmured, focusing my thoughts on the dead queen's face. Tatiana, come to me. I had once been able to summon one ghost easily, my friend Mason, who'd been killed by Strigoi. While Tatiana and I weren't as close as Mason and I had been, we certainly had a connection. For a while, nothing happened. The same blur of faces swirled before me in the cell, and I began to despair. Then, all of a sudden, she was there. She stood in the clothes she'd been murdered in, a long nightgown and robe covered in blood. Her colors were muted, flickering like a malfunctioning TV screen. Nonetheless, the crown on her head and regal stance gave her the same queenly air I remembered. Once she materialized, she said and did nothing. She simply stared at me, her dark gaze practically piercing my soul. A tangle of emotions tightened in my chest, that gut reaction I always got around Tatiana. Anger and resentment flared up. Then, it was muddled by a surprising wave of sympathy. No one's life should end the way hers had. I hesitated, afraid the guards would hear me. Somehow I had a feeling the volume of my voice didn't matter, and none of them could see what I saw. I held up the note. "Did you write this?" I breathed. "Is it true?" She continued to stare. Mason's ghost had behaved similarly. Summoning the dead was one thing. Communicating with them was a whole other matter. "I have to know. If there is another Dragomir, I'll find them." No point in drawing attention to the fact that I was in no position to find anything or anyone. "But you have to tell me. Did you write this letter? Is it true?" Only that maddening gaze answered me. My frustration grew, and the pressure of all those spirits began to give me a headache. Apparently, Tatiana was as annoying in death as she had been in life. I was about to bring my walls back and push the ghosts away when Tatiana made the smallest of movements. It was a tiny nod, barely noticeable. Her hard eyes then shifted down to the note in my hand, and just like that, she was gone. I slammed my barriers back up, using all my will to close myself off from the dead. The headache didn't disappear, but those faces did. I sank back on the bed and stared at the note without seeing it. There was my answer. The note was real. Tatiana had written it. Somehow, I doubted her ghost had any reason to lie. Stretching out, I rested my head on the pillow and waited for that terrible throbbing to go away. I closed my eyes and used the spirit bond to return and see what Lissa had been doing. Since my arrest, she'd been busy pleading and arguing on my behalf. So I expected to find more of the same. Instead, she was dress shopping. I was almost offended at my best friend's frivolity, until I realized she was looking for a funeral dress. She was in one of the court's tucked-away stores, one that catered to royal families. To my surprise, Adrian was with her. Seeing his familiar, handsome face eased some of the fear in me. A quick probe of her mind told me why he was here. She'd talked him into coming because she didn't want him left alone. I could understand why. He was completely drunk. It was a wonder he could stand, and in fact, I strongly suspected the wall he leaned against was all that held him up. His brown hair was a mess, and not in the purposeful way he usually styled it. His deep green eyes were bloodshot. Like Lissa, Adrian was a spirit user. He had an ability she didn't yet. He could visit people's dreams. I'd expected him to come to me since my imprisonment, and now it made sense why he hadn't. Alcohol stunted spirit. In some ways, that was a good thing. Excessive spirit created a darkness that drove its users insane. But spending life perpetually drunk wasn't all that healthy either. Seeing him through Lissa's eyes triggered emotional confusion nearly as intense as what I'd experienced with Tatiana. I felt bad for him. He was obviously worried and upset about me. And the startling events this last week had blindsided him as much as the rest of us. He'd also lost his aunt, whom, despite her brusque attitude, he'd cared for. Yet, in spite of all this, I felt scorn. That was unfair, perhaps, but I couldn't help it. I cared about him so much and understood him being upset, but there were better ways of dealing with his loss. His behavior was almost cowardly. He was hiding from his problems in a bottle, something that went against every piece of my nature. Me? I couldn't let my problems win without a fight.
Velvet, the shopkeeper told Lissa with certainty. The wizened Maroi woman held up a voluminous, long-sleeved gown. Velvet is traditional in the royal escort.
Along with the rest of the fanfare, Tatiana's funeral would have a ceremonial escort walking alongside the coffin, with a representative from each family there. Apparently no one minded that Lissa filled that role for her family, but voting? That was another matter. Lissa eyed the dress. It looked more like a Halloween costume than a funeral gown.
It's 90 degrees out, said Lissa, and humid.
Tradition demands sacrifice, the woman said melodramatically, as does tragedy.
Adrian opened his mouth, undoubtedly ready with some inappropriate and mocking comment. Lissa gave him a sharp headshake that kept him quiet.
Aren't there any, I don't know, sleeveless options?
The saleswoman's eyes widened.
No one has ever worn straps to a royal funeral. It wouldn't be right.
What about shorts?
Asked Adrian.
Are they okay if they're with a tie? Because that's what I was gonna go with.
The woman looked horrified. Lissa shot Adrian a look of disdain, not so much because of the remark, which she found mildly amusing, but because she too was disgusted by his constant state of intoxication.
Well, no one treats me like a full-fledged royal, said Lissa, turning back to the dresses. No reason to act like one now. Show me your straps and short sleeves.
The saleswoman grimaced, but complied. She had no problem advising royals on fashion, but wouldn't dare order them to do or wear anything. It was part of the class stratification of our world.
The woman walked across the store to find the requested dresses, just as Lissa's boyfriend and his aunt entered the shop. Christian Ozera, I thought, was who Adrian should have been acting like. The fact that I could even think like that was startling. Times had certainly changed when I held Christian up as a role model. But it was true. I'd watched him with Lissa this last week, and Christian had been determined and steadfast, doing whatever he could to help her in the wake of Tatiana's death and my arrest. From the look on his face now, it was obvious he had something important to relay. His outspoken aunt, Tasha Ozera, was another study in strength and grace under pressure. She'd raised him after his parents had turned Strigoi, and had attacked her, leaving Tasha with scarring on one side of her face. Maroi had always relied on guardians for defense, but after that attack, Tasha had decided to take matters into her own hands. She'd learned to fight, training with all sorts of hand-to-hand methods and weapons. She was really quite a badass, and constantly pushed for other Maroi to learn combat, too. Lissa let go of a dress she'd been examining and turned to Christian eagerly. After me, there was no one else she trusted more in the world. He'd been her rock throughout all of this. He looked around the store, not appearing overly thrilled to be surrounded by dresses.
"You guys are shopping?"
he asked, glancing from Lissa to Adrian.
"Getting in a little girl time?" "Hey, you'd benefit from a wardrobe change," said Adrian. "Besides, I bet you'd look great in a halter top."
Lissa ignored the guy's banter and focused on the Ozeras. "What did you find out?"
"They've decided not to take action," said Christian,
his lips curled in disdain.
"Well, not any punishment kind of action."
Tasha nodded.
"We're trying to push the idea that he just thought Rose was in danger and jumped in before he realized what was actually happening."
My heart stopped. Dimitri. They were talking about Dimitri. For a moment, I was no longer with Lissa. I was no longer in my cell. Instead, I was back to the day of my arrest. I'd been arguing with Dimitri in a cafe, scolding him for his continued refusal to talk to me, let alone continue our former relationship. I'd decided then that I was done with him, that things were truly over, and that I wouldn't let him keep tearing my heart apart. That was when the guardians had come for me. And no matter what Dimitri claimed about his Strigoi time, making him unable to love, he had reacted with lightning speed in my defense. We'd been hopelessly outnumbered, but he hadn't cared. The look on his face, and my own uncanny understanding of him, had told me all I needed to know. I was facing a threat. He had to defend me. And defend me he had. He'd fought like the god he'd been back at St. Vladimir's Academy, when he taught me how to battle Strigoi. He incapacitated more guardians in that cafe than one man should have been able to. The only thing that had ended it, and I truly believe he would have fought until his last breath, had been my intervention. I hadn't known at the time what was going on or why a legion of guardians would want to arrest me. But I had realized that Dimitri was in serious danger of harming his already fragile status around court. A Strigoi being restored was unheard of, and many still didn't trust him. I'd begged Dimitri to stop, more afraid of what would happen to him than me. Little had I known what was in store for me. He'd come to my hearing, under guard, but neither Lissa nor I had seen him since. Lissa had been working hard to clear him of any wrongdoing, fearing they'd lock him up again. And me? I'd been trying to tell myself not to overthink what he had done. My arrest and potential execution took precedence. Yet, I still wondered. Why had he done it? Why had he risked his life for mine? Was it an instinctive reaction to a threat? Had he done it as a favor to Lissa, whom he'd sworn to help in return for freeing him? Or had he truly done it because he still had feelings for me? I still didn't know the answer, but seeing him like that, like the fierce Dimitri from my past, had stirred up the feelings I was so desperately trying to get over. I kept trying to assure myself that recovering from a relationship took time. Lingering feelings were natural. Unfortunately, it took longer to get over a guy when he threw himself into danger for you. Regardless, Christian and Tasha's words gave me hope about Dimitri's fate. After all, I wasn't the only one walking a tenuous line between life and death. Those convinced Dimitri was still Strigoi wanted to see a stake through his heart.
"They're keeping him confined again," said Christian. "But not in a cell. Just in his room, with a couple of guards. They don't want him out around court until things settle down."
"That's better than jail," admitted Lissa.
"It's still absurd," snapped Tasha, more to herself than the others.
She and Dimitri had been close over the years, and she'd once wanted to take that relationship to another level. She'd settled for friendship, and her outrage over the injustice done to him was as strong as ours.
"They should have let him go as soon as he became a Dampir again. Once the elections are settled, I'm going to make sure he's free."
"And that's what's weird."
Christian's pale blue eyes narrowed thoughtfully.
"We heard that Tatiana had told others before she...
Christian hesitated and glanced uneasily at Adrian. The pause was uncharacteristic for Christian, who usually spoke his mind abruptly.
"Before she was murdered,"
said Adrian flatly, not looking at any of them.
"Go on."
Christian swallowed.
Yeah. I guess, not in public, she'd announced that she believed Dimitri really was a Dampir again. Her plan was to help him get more acceptance once the other stuff settled down.
The other stuff was the age law mentioned in Tatiana's note. The one saying Dampirs turning 16 would be forced to graduate and start defending Maroi. It had infuriated me. But like so many other things now, well, it was kind of on hold. Adrian made a strange sound, like he was clearing his throat.
"She did not,"
Christian shrugged.
"Lots of her advisors said she did. That's the rumor."
"I have a hard time believing it too," Tasha told Adrian. She'd never approved of Tatiana's policies and had vehemently spoken out against them on more than one occasion. Adrian's disbelief wasn't political, though. His was simply coming from ideas he'd always had about his aunt. She'd never given any indication that she wanted to help Dimitri regain his old status. Adrian made no further comment, but I knew this topic was kindling sparks of jealousy within him. I'd told him Dimitri was in the past and that I was ready to move on, but Adrian, like me, must have undoubtedly wondered about the motivations behind Dimitri's gallant defense. Lissa began to speculate on how they might get Dimitri out of house arrest when the saleswoman returned with an armful of dresses she clearly disapproved of. Biting her lip, Lissa fell silent. She filed away Dimitri's situation as something to deal with later. Instead, she wearily prepared to try on clothes and play the part of a good little royal girl. Adrian perked up at the sight of the dresses.
"Any halters in there?"
I returned to my cell, mulling over the problems that just seemed to keep piling up. I was worried about both Adrian and Dimitri. I was worried about myself. I was also worried about this so-called lost Dragomir. I was starting to believe the story could be real, but there was nothing I could do about it, which frustrated me. I needed to take action when it came to helping Lissa. Tatiana had told me in her letter to be careful whom I spoke to about the matter. Should I pass this mission on to someone else? I wanted to take charge of it, but the bars and suffocating walls around me said I might not be able to take charge of anything for a while. Not even my own life. 2 weeks.
Needing further distraction, I gave in and began reading Abe's book, which was exactly the tale of wrongful imprisonment I'd expected it to be. It was pretty good, and taught me that faking my own death apparently wouldn't work as an escape method. The book unexpectedly stirred up old memories. A chill went down my spine as I recalled a tarot reading that a Maroi named Rhonda had given to me. She was Ambrose's aunt, and one of the cards she'd drawn for me had shown a woman tied to swords. Wrongful imprisonment, accusations, slander. Damn, I was really starting to hate those cards. I always insisted they were a scam, yet they had an annoying tendency to come true. The end of her reading had shown a journey, but to where? A real prison? My execution? Questions with no answers. Welcome to my world. Out of options for now, I figured I might as well try to get some rest. Stretching out on the pallet, I tried to push away those constant worries. Not easy. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw a judge banging a gavel, condemning me to death. I saw my name in the history books, not as a hero, but as a traitor. Lying there, choking on my own fear, I thought of Dimitri. I pictured his steady gaze and could practically hear him lecturing me.
Don't worry now about what you can't change. Rest when you can so you'll be ready for tomorrow's battles.
The imaginary advice calmed me. Sleep came at last, heavy and deep. I'd tossed and turned a lot this week, so true rest was welcome. Then, I woke up. I sat upright in bed, my heart pounding. Peering around, I looked for danger. Any threat that might have startled me out of that sleep. There was nothing. Darkness, silence. The faint squeak of a chair down the hall told me my guards were still around. The bond, I realized. The bond had woken me up. I'd felt a sharp, intense flare of... what? Intensity. Anxiety. A rush of adrenaline. Panic raced through me, and I dove deeper into Lyssa, trying to find what had caused that surge of emotion from her. What I found was... nothing. The bond was gone.
Chapter 3. Well, not gone exactly. Muted. Kind of like how it had felt immediately after she'd restored Dimitri back to a Dampier. The magic had been so strong then that it had burned out our link. There was no blast of magic now. It was almost as though the blankness was intentional on her part. Like always, I still had a sense of Lyssa. She was alive. She was well. So what was keeping me from feeling more of her? She wasn't asleep, because I could feel a sense of alert consciousness on the other side of this wall. Spirit was there, hiding her from me. And she was making it happen. What the hell? It was an accepted fact that our bond worked only one way. I could sense her, she couldn't sense me. Likewise, I could control when I went into her mind. Often I tried to keep myself out, jail captivity time excluded, in an attempt to protect her privacy. Lyssa had no such control, and her vulnerability infuriated her sometimes. Every once in a while, she could use her power to shield herself from me, but it was rare, difficult, and required considerable effort on her part. Today she was pulling it off, and as the condition persisted, I could feel her strain. Keeping me out wasn't easy. But she was managing it. Of course, I didn't care about the how of it. I wanted to know the why. It was probably my worst day of imprisonment. Fear for myself was one thing, but for her, that was agonizing. If it was my life or hers,
I would have walked into execution without hesitation. I had to know what was going on. Had she learned something? Had the council decided to skip right over a trial and execute me? Was Lyssa trying to protect me from that news? The more spirit she wielded, the more she endangered her life. This mental wall required a lot of magic. But why? Why was she taking this risk? It was astonishing in that moment to realize just how much I relied on the bond to keep track of her. True, I didn't always welcome someone else's thoughts in my head, despite the control I'd learned. Her mind still sometimes poured into mine in moments I'd rather not experience. None of that was a concern now. Only her safety was. Being blocked off was like having a limb removed. All day I tried to get inside her head. Every time I was kept out. It was maddening. No visitors came to me either, and the book and magazines had long since lost their appeal. The caged animal feeling was getting to me again, and I spent a fair amount of time yelling at my guards, with no results. Tatiana's funeral was tomorrow, and the clock to my trial was ticking loudly. Bedtime came, and the wall in the bond dropped at last, because Lyssa went to sleep. The link between us was firm, but her mind was closed off in unconsciousness. I'd find no answers there. Left with nothing else, I went to bed as well, wondering if I'd be cut off again in the morning. I wasn't. She and I were linked again, and I was able to see the world through her eyes once more. Lyssa was up and around early, preparing for the funeral. I neither saw nor felt any sign of why I'd been blocked the day before. She was letting me back into her mind, just like normal. I almost wondered if I'd imagined being cut off from her. No, there it was. Barely. Within her mind, I sensed thoughts she was still hiding from me. They were slippery. Each time I tried to grasp them, they fell out of my hands. I was amazed she could still use enough magic to pull it off. And it was also a clear indication that she'd blocked me out intentionally yesterday. What was going on? Why on earth would she need to hide something from me? What could I do about anything, locked in this hellhole? Again, my unease grew. What awful thing didn't I know about? I watched Lyssa get ready, seeing no ostensible sign of anything unusual. The dress she'd ended up selecting had cap sleeves and went to the knee. Black, of course. It was hardly a clubbing dress, but she knew it would raise some eyebrows. Under different circumstances, this would have delighted me. She chose to wear her hair down and unbound, its pale blonde color showing brightly against the dress's black when she surveyed herself in a mirror. Christian met Lyssa outside. He cleaned up well, I had to admit, uncharacteristically wearing a dress shirt and tie. He'd drawn the line at a jacket, and his expression was an odd mix of nervousness, secrecy, and typical snark. When he saw Lyssa, though, his face momentarily transformed, turning radiant and awestruck as he gazed at her. He gave her a small smile and took her into his arms for a brief embrace. His touch brought her contentment and comfort, easing her anxiety. They'd gotten back together recently after a breakup, and that time apart had been agonizing for both of them.
"It's going to be okay," he murmured, his look of worry returning. "This'll work. We can do this."
She said nothing but tightened her hold on him before stepping back. Neither of them spoke as they walked to the beginning of the funeral procession. I decided this was suspicious. She caught hold of his hand and felt strengthened by it. The funeral procedures for Meroe monarchs had been the same for centuries, no matter if the court was in Romania or its new home in Pennsylvania. That was the Meroe way. They mixed the traditional with the modern, magic with technology. The queen's coffin would be carried by pallbearers out of the palace and taken with great ceremony all through the court's grounds, until it reached the court's imposing cathedral. There, a select group would enter for mass. After the service, Tatiana would be buried in the church's graveyard, taking her place beside other monarchs and important royals. The coffin's route was easy to spot. Poles strung with red and black silk banners marked each side. Rose petals had been strewn on the ground the coffin would pass over. Along the sides, people crammed together, hoping to catch a glimpse of their former queen. Many Moroi had come from far-off places, some to see the funeral, and some to see the monarch elections that would soon follow over the next couple of weeks. The royal family escort, most of whom wore saleswoman-approved black velvet, were already heading into the palace building. Lissa stopped outside to part ways with Christian since he certainly had never been in the running to represent his family for such an honored event. She gave him another fierce hug and a light kiss. As they stepped away, there was a knowing glint in his blue eyes. That secret that was hidden from me. Lissa pushed through the gathering crowds, trying to get to the entrance and find the procession's starting point. The building didn't look like the palaces or castles of ancient Europe. Its grand stone facade and tall windows matched the court's other structures. But a few features, its height, wide marble steps, subtly distinguished it from other buildings. A tug at Lissa's arm stopped her progress, nearly causing her to run into an ancient Moroi man.
Vasilisa?
It was Daniela Ivashkov, Adrian's mother. Daniela wasn't so bad as royals went, and she was actually okay with Adrian and me dating. Or at least she had been before I became an accused murderer. Most of Daniela's acceptance had come from the fact that she believed Adrian and I would split up anyways once I received my guardian assignment. Daniela had also convinced one of her cousins, Damon Taurus, to be my lawyer, an offer I'd rejected when I chose Abe to represent me instead. I still wasn't entirely sure if I'd made the best decision there, but it probably tarnished Daniela's view of me, which I regretted. Lissa offered up a nervous smile. She was anxious to join the procession and get all of this over with.
Hi,
she said. Daniela was dressed in full black velvet and even had small diamond barrettes shining in her dark hair. Worry and agitation lined her pretty face.
Have you seen Adrian? I haven't been able to find him anywhere. We checked his room.
Oh, Lissa averted her eyes.
What?
Daniela nearly shook her.
What do you know?
Lissa sighed.
I'm not sure where he is, but I saw him last night when he was coming back from some party.
Lissa hesitated, like she was too embarrassed to tell the rest.
He was really drunk, more than I've ever seen him. He was going off with some girls, and I don't know. I'm sorry, Lady Ivashkov. He's probably, well, passed out somewhere.
Daniela wrung her hands and I shared her dismay.
I hope nobody notices. Maybe we can say he was overcome with grief. There's so much going on. Surely no one will notice. You'll tell them, right? You'll say how upset he was?
I liked Daniela, but this royal obsession with image was really starting to bug me. I knew she loved her son, but her main concern here seemed to be less about Tatiana's final rest than it was about what others would think about a breach of protocol.
Of course, said Lissa. I wouldn't want anyone to... Well, I'd hate for that to get out. Thank you. Now go.
Daniela gestured to the doors, still looking anxious.
You need to take your place.
To Lissa's surprise, Daniela gave her a gentle pat on the arm.
And don't be nervous. You'll do fine. Just keep your head up.
Guardians stationed at the door recognized Lissa as someone with access and allowed her in. There, in the foyer, was Tatiana's coffin. Lissa froze, suddenly overwhelmed, and nearly forgot what she was doing there. The coffin alone was a work of art. It was made of gleaming black wood, polished to brilliance. Paintings of elaborate garden scenes in shining metallic colors of every hue adorned each side. Gold glittered everywhere, including the poles that the pallbearers would hold. Those poles were draped with strings of mauve roses. It seemed like the thorns and leaves would make it difficult for the pallbearers to get a good grip, but that was their problem to deal with. Inside, uncovered and lying on a bed of more mauve roses, was Tatiana herself. It was strange. I saw dead bodies all the time. Hell, I created them. But seeing a body that had been preserved, lying peacefully and ornamentally? Well, it was creepy. It was strange for Lyssa, too, particularly since she didn't have to deal with death as often as I did. Tatiana wore a gleaming silk gown that was a rich shade of purple, the traditional color for royal burial. The dress's long sleeves were decorated with an elaborate design of small pearls. I'd often seen Tatiana in red, a color associated with the Ivashkov family, and I was glad for the purple burial tradition. A red dress would have been too strong a reminder of the bloody pictures of her that I'd seen at my hearing, pictures I kept trying to block out. Strings of gemstones and more pearls hung around her neck, and a gold crown set with diamonds and amethysts rested upon her graying hair. Someone had done a good job with Tatiana's makeup, but even they couldn't hide the whiteness of her skin. Maroi were naturally pale. In death, they were like chalk, like Strigoi. The image struck Lyssa so vividly that she swayed on her feet a little and had to look away. The rose's scent filled the air, but there was a hint of decay mixed in with that sweetness. The funeral coordinator spotted Lyssa and ordered her into position, after first bemoaning Lyssa's fashion choice. The sharp word snapped Lyssa back to reality, and she fell in line with five other royals on the right side of the coffin. She tried not to look too closely at the queen's body and directed her gaze elsewhere. The pallbearers soon showed up and lifted their burden, using the rose-draped poles to rest the coffin on their shoulders and slowly carry it out to the waiting crowd. The pallbearers were all dompiers. They wore formal suits, which confused me at first, but then I realized they were all court guardians, except one, Ambrose. He looked as gorgeous as always and stared straight ahead as he did his job, face blank and expressionless. I wondered if Ambrose mourned Tatiana. I was so fixated on my own problems that I kept forgetting a life had been lost here, a life that many had loved. Ambrose had defended Tatiana when I'd been angry about the age law. Watching him through Lyssa's eyes, I wished I was there to speak to him in person. He had to know something more about the letter he'd slipped me in the courtroom. Surely he wasn't just the delivery boy. The procession moved forward, ending my musings about Ambrose. Before and ahead of the coffin were other ceremonial people, royals in elaborate clothing, making a glittering display, uniformed guardians carrying banners. Musicians with flutes walked at the very back, playing a mournful tune. For her part, Lyssa was very good at public appearances and managed the slow, stately pace with elegance and grace, her gaze level and confident. I couldn't see outside her body, of course, but it was easy to imagine what the spectators saw. She was beautiful and regal, worthy to inherit the Dragomir legacy, and hopefully more and more would realize that. It would save us a lot of trouble if someone would change the voting law through standard procedures, so we didn't have to rely on a quest for a lost sibling. Walking the funeral route took a long time. Even when the sun started sinking down toward the horizon, the day's heat still hung in the air. Lyssa began to sweat but knew her discomfort was nothing compared to the pallbearers. If the watching crowd felt the heat, they didn't show it. They craned their necks to get their one glimpse of the spectacle passing before them. Lyssa didn't process the onlookers so much, but in their faces, I saw that the coffin wasn't their only focus.